Welcome to Open Minds, a Freedom of Thought podcast series, interviewing the people who bring courage and independent thought to the challenges of today.
Welcome again to the Freedom of Thought podcast/videocast. My name is Josh Kleinfeld. I'm a law professor at Northwestern and George Mason Universities, and you are the John S. Battle Professor of Law at the University of Virginia.
Yes.
So we are going to have a conversation today about freedom of thought in diverse professional worlds, universities to law to corporations to medicine. And I thought I would set up our conversation with this. There are some things you know when you feel them. You know when you're in love, you know when you're having fun, and you know when you're free. As I experience the world, as so many people I know experience the world, they feel deeply unfree in America today. It's the sense of not being free, the sense of unfreedom is ideological, and it's interpersonal, and it's institutional. It has to do with a set of political attitudes and taboos, mostly centered around identity and ideology. And it has to do with speech and thought. It has to do with this sense of jeopardy, this sense that there are all around you sanctions, some interpersonal. You might be ostracized or shunned or spoken badly of in ways that hurt your reputation. Some of them are reputational in the sense of your professional reputation. You might lose out on various professional opportunities if you're thought of as one of the bad people in terms of your thoughts and speech. Some of them are just purely professional sanctions, even formal sanctions. You know, you might get fired, you might get disciplined, you might get a file written about you. And they're all centered on this idea of breaking ranks with a certain set of identity, ideas, and an ideology and the taboos surrounding it. So part of the story here is just about power. It's about cultural and interpersonal power. And the level of that power is just incredible. A challenge to the orthodoxy doesn't just lead to disagreement, which we all expect, right? It leads to enmity. It leads to moral condemnation. It leads to ostracism. But the power is also institutional. It's pervasive in our schools and our universities, and it's also pervasive in the professional settings where we work. Our hospitals and our law firms and our government employers and all the other places where we carry on our lives. There's this sense that if you break ranks, if you disagree with the prevailing orthodoxy, there'll be real consequences. You might get fired, you might get disciplined, or you might just be passed over for promotions and other opportunities. So I want to think with you about this unfreedom, but I want to do it in a certain way. Let's go sphere by sphere. Start with the corporate sphere, then the law firms, and then the universities, and then the nonprofits, and then the world of science and medicine. And in each one, asking the same set of questions. So let's start with the corporate sphere, and here are my questions. Are we in fact unfree? Is that feeling I described, that feeling of, you know when you're in love, know when you're having fun, and you know when you're free, and I know I'm not free, is that feeling justified? And why are we in this situation? Why don't we feel free? Why aren't we free in our workplaces in the corporate sphere? And what might be done about it?
So the corporate sphere has never been completely free. People have always expected and been expected to, in effect, focus on the job, not bring their political and ideological commitments to work in a way that could distract other employees. So what has changed is that a lot of people are reporting that they feel constrained at work from doing the best job that they can because of possible getting on the wrong side of someone, for example. So if a corporation is embarking on a policy that workers, or at least some workers, think reasonably is not in the best interests of the investors, sometimes they might hesitate to speak up. And that's a very bad situation because, of course, those who run corporations are if they're publicly traded corporations or if they have taken investors' money, if they're not the sole owners of the firm, they are fiduciaries for others, and they must act in the fiduciary's interests. So to me, this is a worrisome development in society. Now, obviously, for a publicly traded corporation, there is a market in corporate control. And if those who run corporations are pursuing ideological projects rather than acting as faithful fiduciaries, then they should be taken over. Of course, the market for corporate control is far from perfect, so that might not happen. In addition, those who run firms are not focused on developing good products, et cetera, building a good reputation, doing all the things that we expect people who competently manage firms to do, then they should be outcompeted by rivals. However, in a highly regulated society, we know that it can occur that competition will not act as quickly as we would like.
Let me ask some skeptical questions. That seems to be our rhythm, is that I ask the skeptical questions. Okay, sure. It was always the case that in your corporate job, you weren't supposed to talk about politics all the time in ways that interfered with doing the work or upset all the people around you. But now, actually, there are a lot of people in corporate jobs who do talk politics all the time, and as long as they talk about them the right way, they actually get rewarded. And if they talk about them in the wrong way, they get really punished. And that does seem to be a profound change.
Yes.
So if you go to your job at a law firm, for example, which is probably the corporate world I know best, but I think this is equally true in many, many other areas of big banks or other financial sector actors or big tech or whatever else, there's a set of beliefs that are largely the beliefs of the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. They're centered on identity and ideology and similar concerns. And if you break ranks with those beliefs, you get punished. Now, I don't think it was always the case that in the corporate sphere of America, they were unified behind a certain wing of a certain party. And if you broke ranks with that party, you would get in trouble at work. Maybe I'm wrong. I mean, is there precedent for this in American history? Yeah. Are there other instances where, you know, all the law firms, virtually all the law firms or virtually all the for-profit publicly traded corporations were on the same side in terms of who they vote for? And if you break ranks with that, you have professional consequences?
Well, some would point to the Red Scare in the 1940s and 1950s,
okay,
and say that a number of people were unfairly excluded from jobs because of the mere suspicion that they might have some entanglement with or some serious interest in socialist principles. But moving on along to the world of today, it is a very bad thing when the efficacy of a firm is compromised by things that are not central to the mission. And it may well be that we are seeing that. Now, what's the solution? One solution, thinking about law firms, for example, is other firms. And we have already seen some boutique law firms being formed by those who no longer felt welcome at large elite law firms. We may see more of that. We saw a great deal of concentration in the law firm world. We saw mega firms formed. Maybe we're going to see now some, in effect, some splitting up, and that will provide a partial solution. Of course, you may respond, I think, accurately, well, that will take a while. And meanwhile, we have a lot of lawyers, including a lot of young lawyers, who feel that their careers may depend upon putting up with stuff in the workforce, having to pretend to go along with various ideological commitments, that it really people shouldn't have to pretend to go along with that work. And what are we going to do about that? So we could, for example, have some kind of regulation, although I'm, as you know, something of a skeptic that regulations along those lines could be effective.
Yeah. So do you think there's been a change in the corporate sphere that justifies this feeling of not being free? I mean, maybe
yes.
We never felt completely free at work, right? We always had to put on a professional face and behave in a certain way that isn't how we behave at home, and that's to be expected. But that there's something more like an ideology that you're required at least not to disagree with, to confront, if you want to advance in most of the workplace now. And that really contributes to the sense of unfreedom. You agree with that?
Well, many people are reporting exactly that.
Yeah.
And their accounts are credible. So this is not a universal experience, clearly, but we have more people explaining that this is their work life, that they cannot speak up, and it's not just they cannot speak up about their political convictions, it's that they cannot speak up when they believe that their firm is not doing the best job that it could because it could get them into hot water in some way. That is a very serious development and one that, in my view, demands attention.
And I have an additional question. So one way of thinking about this is there's a group of people who disagree but are afraid to say so. And they're the ones whose freedom is at issue, right? So whatever percentage that is of, like, you know, students join or want to join law firms, for example, they graduate from law school, and some portion of them, call it 10%, to guesstimate 15-20%, disagree with the ideology that's being espoused by the power holders or by the majority of their law firm and wish they could say so, but they don't feel they can. And likewise in other corporate jobs in a variety of different sectors. Another possibility, then you think it's a freedom problem for that 10 to 20%.
Well, others
another
do.
Possibility is that even the people who agree with this aren't completely free. They're in an environment which is propagandizing them or conditioning them or demanding things of them that even if they agree with, somehow their freedom is impinged too, or they don't even feel free, notwithstanding the fact that they agree. And I can't get my head around that. Are they unfree too?
Yes.
What do you think?
Of course they're unfree.
So, but why? I mean, they don't, it's kind of like telling me I'm unfree because I don't get to drive 120 miles an hour. I don't want to drive 120 miles an hour, so I'm free insofar as my preferences can be met.
They're unfree because a crucial part of freedom is the ability to listen, the ability to be exposed to new ideas. Even if you agree with something at this point, well, and even if that belief is true, that belief might become false over the next couple of years. And if you're not able to hear why a belief you held is no longer true, that's a problem, I would say, for your personal development, for your freedom. If you, and you, of course, will change as a person. So beliefs that fit you when you were 18 will have to be rethought. Maybe you won't do a 180-degree turn, but you will certainly add nuance.
So the thought is, part of your freedom, whether you know that you want it or not, or whether you like it or not, part of your freedom is hearing ideas you disagree with.
Yes, and engaging with them. And not just disagree, but hearing, you may skew to your current beliefs, roughly speaking, but it is often hearing ideas that are not in accordance with them that will allow you to strengthen your own convictions.
I think there's another, I agree with that, I actually think that's deeply insightful, but I think there's another factor. We tend to imagine that people's beliefs are fairly stable elements of their, I guess we could say, political personality or just personality writ large. But that isn't really true. I mean, people go into these environments and they're shaped by the environment around them. It takes a very unusual personality to have virtually everyone around you saying, this is what is true, this is what is right and wrong, this is, you know, what good people believe, and to think, no, I disagree, no, I disagree, no, I disagree. Most people are highly affected by what the people around them believe. I would even go so far as to say most of what people think is what people around them think. That's just like sort of the human condition. And I also think that people are highly affected in their beliefs by their incentives. So if going along with a sort of progressive set of ideas about identity, for example, is what is required for you to get ahead at work, you will tend to convince yourself of those because you have an interest in getting ahead at work. And I think, in other words, people are formed by their incentives and by their social environment to such a degree that even if they feel a kind of alignment of their beliefs and those that are espoused by their institution, they're not necessarily free if they themselves were sort of formed in those conditions.
Yes, you could certainly put it that way. So with corporate America, I think there has to be a recommitment to the mission of...
Which commission is that, though?
Oh, to the mission, to whatever the firm mission is.
Oh, the firm mission.
The firm mission, and an understanding that if there is a deviation from that mission, that that is not in the interests of the of those whose money is being managed.
What if they just say our mission is to, you know, make widgets and do social justice? Our mission is to, you know, build power plants and do social justice. Our mission is, you know, et cetera.
If their if their investors agree, that's fine. If it's clear to those who have entrusted their money, then okay. But that is often not the case. And even if an investor is interested in social justice, as that particular firm defines it, there's still a difficulty in executing a dual mission. It's hard to have one firm both make financial returns and carry out altruistic projects or political projects. Perhaps not impossible. But what this all gets back to, for me anyway, is are the investors in a profit-seeking firm aware of what's going on? If they have agreed to take a lower return in exchange for some of their money being spent on various political, ideological, altruistic projects, well, okay then. But everyone involved has to be absolutely clear.
I guess I have two points of doubt. One is that it is very difficult to prove that a profitable firm would be still more profitable if it was not spending money on its ideological mission. There's usually an argument that can be made that the ideological mission is either low cost or costless or even profitable. And it's almost impossible to prove the contrary, I think. Tell me if I'm wrong. The other point of doubt...
Not almost impossible. It can be hard.
Let's
I would say very firmly that they are two different issues, right? What it is right for people to be doing and the degree to which they can be called to account for it. They are two separate issues. We can say that we can agree that there are many things that are happening that are wrong and also think that many of the bad actors won't be called to account.
But the way you're thinking of this is that the you know, there's this pervasive feeling of being unfree of work. And as I said in our previous hour, this is where most people encounter power. You know, some people have the experience of the police pounding on the door and grabbing them, to be sure. But most people encounter power at the places they work. That's the power holders they relate to on a daily basis. Those are the ones who say, stay home with COVID or come to work on COVID. Those are the ones who say, you're going to make more money or less. Those are the ones who say, here's our standards for your behavior with regard to your most essential interests. So there's this real encounter with power at work. And this sense of unfreedom, I guess in accounting for it, you go back to like betraying investors. But what about betraying employees? I mean, is it possible to just say employees have a right not to be made to feel this way? They quite apart from what's in the investor's interest. I'm going to be agnostic about what's profitable for shareholders, but employees have a right not to be made to feel like expressing their political views or expressing a contrary view to the dominant position at the firm will cost them their jobs or their prospects.
I mean, I think if we have a discussion amongst ourselves about what kind of society we want to live in, that most people would agree with you. The question is, how are you going to enforce it? Now, there are we will also talk about the nonprofit sector.
We will in a moment. I'll get there, but I just wanted to exhaust this one first. And I do have one more question about this for-profit.
Speaking with corporate America.
Focusing for just a moment longer on the shareholder problem. I pointed out that the shareholder perspective might leave out the employee perspective, but here's the other thing. As I understand it, corporate ownership has gotten concentrated. And I'm sure you know this story much better than I do. But as I understand it, six firms own much of the stock in America. There are Vanguard, BlackRock, and a handful of others. And essentially, everyone's 401ks are at those firms. And those firms are the activists and majority shareholders in a whole lot of publicly traded firms. So what pleases shareholders is essentially what pleases the management teams at six big firms.
Well, it's a little more complicated than that because there is, of course, some pass-through voting and so on. And those who so it's
fill
not,
me in and fill so our audience
not,
in too,
so
please.
It's not that that these BlackRock and State Street and so on actually control all these firms. But I take your point to be that what we are seeing in the United States is enough concentration in the for-profit sector that there are serious questions about whether or not some of the problems that we are discussing are actually going to be competed away, in the sense that if one firm is slacking by paying too much attention to ideology and too little attention to delivering value, as it is supposed to do, ideally, entrants will come, will emerge, will outcompete them, and that firm will be in financial trouble, as the big three automakers in the United States got into difficulty in the late 1970s. And you're right, if there is there are reasons to be concerned about how well these pro-competitive forces function. So an enormous amount of good institutional design for me is paying careful attention to markets for corporate control and how they function to the extent they exist, and also paying attention to pro-competitive laws, regulations, social practices, etc. To me, that's where the solution, the easiest and fastest solution to the problems we've been discussing will lie. And then there are social norms.
So can I be concrete about that? So one thing you might hope for is some sort of intervention in the market for stocks that give a lot of small firms more of the total share of stocks, or a lot of individuals more of the share of total stocks, and fewer of these extremely large institutional players like BlackRock and Vanguard.
Well, you can certainly look carefully at financial regulation and try to ensure that, to the extent there are competitors, actual and potential, to these large firms, that they are able to offer services. Obviously, the financial sector is highly regulated, but I believe it is probably too heavily regulated. Mm-hmm. So heavily regulated that it is difficult for someone to compete with BlackRock and State Street, and I think it should be easier. And that, to me, is worth a lot of attention. Why is it that we have this concentration? Sometimes concentration is the result of other forces than excessive government regulation, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But in the financial industry, it is highly plausible that a great deal of the concentration we've seen is the result of excessive or ill-advised government regulation. We should take a careful look at that.
One more question. Would it be worthwhile to sort of change laws to free up lawsuits by shareholders, by plaintiff firms, essentially, that that some publicly traded corporation is violating its fiduciary duty?
Well, sure. I mean, I think there should be such suits, and there are such suits. The question is...
To redefine fiduciary duty in a broader way so that a certain amount of activism counts as a violation of fiduciary duty.
I think that the issue is bringing the suits and having courts understand that excessive commitment to ideology can, in certain circumstances, amount to a violation of the duty of care.
Okay.
And I think that is absolutely true. And I hope enterprising plaintiffs... firms will think about bringing these suits and bring them. And you're right, they can be hard to demonstrate, but in many cases it won't be hard to demonstrate. And in those cases, there should be suit and a lawsuit, and unfaithful fiduciaries should pay for not doing their jobs.
Well, let's turn to a piece of the one of these social spheres or institutional spheres that is near and dear to both our hearts, and that is law firms. It's the same question. I have the same question I did with respect to the corporate sphere. It'll always be the same question. Are we unfree? Is that feeling that I spoke of earlier, you know, when you're in love, when you're having fun, and when you're free, are we unfree in our law firms? And why has that come to be the situation? And what should be done in the law firm world, especially since they're not, by and large, publicly traded corporations. They're privately held. They're held by the partnership. Is there anything to be done about this feeling, for example, on behalf of my students who are conservative or libertarian? I spoke of it in our last hour. they're terrified of being outed at their law firms as being sort of dissenters, of being conservative or libertarian, of disagreeing with the progressive moral vision. They feel that if they are outed, their prospects of advancement, of getting good work, of becoming partners will all be deeply compromised. And they're scared. Are they right to be scared? And is there anything that can be done about it?
Well, if they say that they are scared, I believe them. And I have heard similar things, not about every law firm, but about enough for me to be very concerned. So there are two things that I think we should consider. First is social norms. The legal world is a relatively small world. Mm-hmm. And if people like us speak up enough, and there are many who share our worries, then there is the possibility that there will be some kind of change. Where things are going wrong, and we are hearing from our students that they are not, that workplaces are in some way feeling that they, hearing that this is not all right, hearing that a lot of people object to it, will convince at least some people that this is not the path of least resistance to go along. Second thing to look at very carefully is, why is it that the legal profession is so protected from competition? We should look very carefully at state bars and consider allowing more people to enter the legal field. If it turns out that those who are now in the legal field are not, in effect, acting in the interest of society, then maybe we need to rethink how we select and maintain our state bars.
I have to express a little skepticism of the social norm solution. Not that social norms aren't powerful, they're very powerful, but that there's any real prospect of criticism essentially effectuating change in these firms' behavior. You know, you and I are kind of privileged in the position that we occupy with respect to the social norms in the legal profession. It's very nice to be a law professor and be able to speak to students in law firms and the whole judges and the whole profession, really, with some credibility. And we've been talking about this sort of issue for years, as have many people who agree with us. And the snowball keeps rolling downhill. That is to say, the progressive moral vision dominating these law firms and entering these law firms, such as to, you know, lead a heterodox thinking law firm to fire, a heterodox thinking partner or associate at a law firm to get fired. Those things just keep getting more powerful, notwithstanding the criticism. I think part of the reason is that we just don't have the numbers. And part of the reason is that for every criticism we make, there's 10 criticisms the other way. And so the social norms don't seem to be working after a lot of decades. I'm very skeptical that just sort of, you know, we have this podcast, we have 20 more, let's imagine, we have 1,000 more, and suddenly the norms are different. I just don't think there's any evidence of that working. Do you? Am I getting this wrong?
Well, some would criticize people like us for not being strong enough, for not being loud enough, for not, in effect, continuing to harp on the importance of the principles that we hold dear. Mm. So I'm not giving up. I don't think it's impossible. But I don't know for sure what it is that is going to change things. But I think we have to try, and we have to start somewhere. And the place to start is to encourage very strongly those who are running law firms to create workplaces where their associates and young partners and so on do not feel like they have to censor themselves, to persuade them that they will have a more effective workforce if people are not so frightened. And I don't see that that effort has yet been made in a serious, vigorous way.
I'm a little skeptical of the competition solution, too. And I guess the reason why is that what I'm actually observing concretely is that a certain number of, my former students who are conservatives and libertarians go to their firms. They're uncomfortable about the dominant ideological environment. They're worried that if they're sort of outed or found out, it's curiously like the situation of homosexual men and women before the sort of social revolution that led to more equality of treatment for them in the workplace. So my conservative and libertarian students are worried that if they're outed or found out, their careers would be destroyed. And so a certain number of them leave, and they go form their own firms. They start new firms that become competitors in the landscape and attract other conservatives and libertarians until you have sort of, but what ends up happening is that just means that the big firms, the ones that have hundreds of millions or billions of dollars in revenue every year and thousands of lawyers and are really moving mountains, they just get more left-wing, more progressive, because the very few dissenters are made so uncomfortable that they leave, and sometimes, of course, they get fired. And I guess competition will work insofar as those startup firms get a certain number of clients who don't find, they find a chilly reception in the conventional firms, and, you know, that sort of competition happens. But it doesn't change the big firms. It just means that the profession sort of bifurcates into the big progressive firms and the little conservative firms. Is that wrong? Is competition doing more than that?
I don't know, is the answer. I mean, I hope that competition will be effective. But
effective at what exactly? At changing the...
As in making it clear that there's a real market for talent and so on, but I don't know.
Right.
I mean, and it would be... I hope that there will be serious inquiries, serious attempts to start with the facts on the ground, because we do not know how many people are, in effect, silent bystanders.
Mm.
I suspect that the reason I think that I am more optimistic than you about attempts to change social norms is that I think it is quite possible that we could see a preference cascade. I think a lot of people don't like this. They don't like bullies. They don't like seeing people being fired or not promoted or simply shunned for trivial reasons, and that they are not going to lead the charge against it, but they will quickly be part of a project to change this. But we don't know. The thing about preference cascades is that one can think, I think there's a big silent majority, or there could be a silent majority, or there could at least be a big chunk of people who want a different kind of life. But you don't know until you try.
And it also hasn't worked so far.
You don't know until you... Many have said that there has not been a serious effort yet to use social norms to push back against some of the things that we are hearing our students complain about.
Last question, with respect to law firms specifically, you've talked about social norms and you've talked about competition. What do you think about legal action? Some sort of governmentally sponsored requirement imposed on law firms? I guess it could come from state bar associations, or it could come from sort of the American Bar Association. It could come, I suppose, from some sort of national regulation of the profession, or from simple liability rules. But somehow a legal change to make law firms more politically nonpartisan.
I would say I'm skeptical, but willing to learn more.
Well, let's turn to another part of the world we mutually occupy, the world we centrally occupy, and that's universities. So, universities, I'll ask my questions, but then I'm going to just answer them myself. You know, are students and professors and administrators in universities programmatically unfree? Is that feeling that I'm not free justified? And my answer is a resounding yes. I mean, the ideological unification on the progressive side in big universities, small universities, high-prestige universities, low-prestige universities, it's just sort of almost across the board. There are a few exceptions, to be sure, but the level of unification and the punishments imposed on dissenters is just overwhelming. It's sort of risible to say that we're genuinely free in our universities. I do really want to hear from you about why that's happened. Like, what happened in our universities? Was there a before when we were more free than we are now? And how did we get from there to here? And what might be done about our university environment?
Yeah, I'm more interested in how we turn the page on this and what we do next. I think it's hard to know exactly why this has happened. It happened quickly, and we have seen higher education fall in terms of public trust in a precipitous way that ought to be setting off alarm bells for everyone in universities. Now, that said, a lot of people, I think, do not yet realize that there is a problem, but there is. look at the recent Gallup poll that showed, in effect, from being between 2015 and 2023, so many people, and across the political spectrum, Democrats, as well as Republicans and independents, have lost a lot of trust in universities. They are not perceived of as pursuing truth. Universities are now perceived of as, in effect, pursuing other objectives.
But to be clear, the problem isn't the loss of public trust in itself. It's that universities warrant that loss of trust. I mean, they're not pursuing
truth
in quite a few contexts.
They do warrant that loss of trust. And one question is, will this sudden loss of trust convince anyone that they need to, in effect, shift gears? We will see. And then, very importantly, what is to be done?
Yeah, in this public loss of trust, I just do not see my passionately ideological colleagues and students who are very, very progressive or even hard left. You know, it depends on who you're talking to, but the spectrum of opinion is kind of from European social democrat on one end to hard left radical on the other end. And I just do not see them reading a Gallup poll and saying we need to change.
Yes, perhaps not. So it may be incumbent upon those who are more heterodox thinking to organize and to put together programs. And we are seeing that. I'm an active member of the Heterodox Academy chapter at the University of Virginia, and we've had a number of very successful events. In addition, the Academic Freedom Alliance, which I was a founding member of, has protected the free speech rights of numerous faculty members, which has certainly gotten a lot of universities to stand down and to allow for freedom of expression and freedom of thought. So I think that's an important beginning.
Yeah.
In addition, there are now some so-called offshore entities, that is, those kind of satellite organizations, the Buckley Program at Yale, the Blue Ridge Center at the University of Virginia, that are committed to providing students with a wide variety of ideas. Now, this is not a substitute for the university mending its ways, I'm not suggesting that, and having more ideas actually on grounds. But it is a start, and I think that the journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step and all that. And to have faculty, to the extent that they can, be committed to the free exchange of ideas is utterly essential. And there are a number of self-described liberal and progressive faculty who are not happy with groupthink, who are not happy with lack of freedom of expression, who understand that a lot of students are reporting that they don't feel free, and who want to be part of constructive change. So thinking back to getting back to the University of Virginia's chapter of the Heterodox Academy, we have a range of members. I would say that probably, certainly quite a few probably describe themselves as libertarian or even conservative, but a lot would describe themselves as liberal or even progressive. So I think it takes effort,
yeah.
It takes time, it takes a willingness to have a big tent, and I am encouraged that we are seeing more faculty organizations. We've seen them recently at Yale and at Harvard and at Columbia. Faculty who get together and say, we want to make sure that there is true freedom of thought and expression at this university, and that so that, among other things, scholarly projects can be pursued without the fear that if things come out the wrong way,
mm-hmm.
that they should never be published, and that, very importantly, students are able to hear ideas, experiment with ideas, and develop the way that universities are supposed to develop students.
So I think those are really hopeful signs. But at the same time, you know, I'm in this world too. And what I observe is little coalitions form between professors who are conservative or libertarian and strongly in favor of sort of free speech and free thought norms with professors who are progressives or liberals of various stripes, but also really agree with free speech and freedom of thought norms and scholarly rigor norms. And the two groups come together, and if they're energetic enough, form coalitions and projects to do a maybe form a heterodox chapter, heterodox society chapter. And of course, they bring in students, some graduate students, some undergraduates who belong to those same two networks. They're either, progressive Democrats of various stripes who just really believe in freedom of speech and freedom of thought, or they're conservatives who sort of desperately need freedom of speech and freedom of thought. We see that happening, and it's extremely welcome and much better than the alternative. But we also see no real effect on the overwhelming bulk of professors and students who are rowing in the same direction. So at Northwestern, you know, where I spent most of my career, for example, you know, I don't know what the numbers are exactly. I would project them based on personal experience and based on some studies I've read to be something in the neighborhood of 95 or 99% of faculty to not agree with those initiatives and to be instructing their students in ways that reflect, every class, if it's in the humanities, is about colonialism and anti-colonialism. It's about racial supremacy and anti-racism. It's like it's got this kind of ideological orientation, and the students are selected for their agreement with that orientation and then are put in a social environment and an educational environment where they are trained to hold those beliefs, and they are socially rewarded for holding those beliefs. And these efforts you're describing are so small, these internal efforts, that it seems like they're really futile unless they're accompanied by external pressure of a much stronger sort than you're imagining.
Well, there must be leadership changes, as in leadership matters.
Right.
And university leadership is ultimately going to be the solution to some of the issues that we are discussing. Now, in terms of the actual educational product at law schools and other parts of the university, there is an enormous amount of instruction and an enormous amount of research that is going on that is not ideological. And from that perspective, there's a lot to be built on. That in effect, there are many, many people in universities who are committed to truth, that see truth as the end of the universe, as the goal, right, of the university, as the purpose of the university, not some kind of ideological project. And so far, this group, which may or may not be a majority, have not been able to ensure that they have leadership of universities who will be committed to the idea that the purpose of a university is to seek truth and to develop students along so that they can be capable, so that they can have fulfilling professional and personal lives. Harvard University is searching for a new president. So is the University of Pennsylvania. Those are private universities, and those new presidents will be selected by very small groups of people who will be, at least up to a point, amenable, or at least will have to take into account what they hear from others about how they should be selecting presidents. And I think it's a great time to let members of the Harvard Corporation and other decision makers know what it is that various constituencies, including alumni and including employers, for example, who might be thinking about hiring the students from these schools, this is a good time for these groups to speak up and explain to those who are choosing these new presidents what they believe these institutions need in a leader. Now, pivoting to public universities, which you and I have talked about a lot over the years, mm-hmm. public universities are politically accountable, and in a way that private universities, at least, are not directly accountable.
Mm-hmm.
With public universities, I think it is absolutely essential that the politicians who have control over these boards exercise it, and in turn, that those who are members of the boards, Board of Visitors, in the case of University of Virginia, but there are other governance structures in other states, that the members of these boards take their duties seriously. Too often, a seat on a public university board is kind of a benefit that's tossed out by a governor, maybe, you know, just to a longtime supporter, mm-hmm. and it hasn't been something that has been considered to be an absolutely crucial task that will take an enormous amount of time and effort and courage. those days, I think, are gone. Absolutely essential that everyone who is on a board, public or private, of a university be committed and be, have the courage to do, to actually pursue the mission of a university. And if we get the right leadership, and that means the right college and university presidents, and the boards of these institutions show focus and courage, then yes, I think we will see significant changes. Moving to external pressures, mm-hmm. we've already seen a slight shift in the law respecting to universities, in that there is now a small tax on some endowment income, on the endowment income of some institutions. Obviously, that tax could become a lot larger, and former, perhaps future, President Trump has suggested the establishment of a national online university financed by, yes, endowment taxes.
Mm, I didn't know that.
And that's pretty vigorous external pressure. If it becomes clear to the richest, most influential university, most prominent, maybe I should say, universities in this country, that they actually might end up making themselves so unpopular that they will be subject to massive taxes, that may lead them to reflect and understand that they are, in fact, accountable up to a point to the general population.
Can I just one more question about this university sphere before we move on to the next one? And that is, you said it happened fast, this unfreedom happened fast, but it doesn't seem like it happened fast to me. First of all, I felt it acutely. I felt that there was a sort of political consensus with social implications and professional implications. When I was going to college in the 90s and early 2000s, I certainly felt it in law school in the mid-2000s. And at that point, at this point, that's 25 years ago and more. And, you know, for example, I used this example in our last hour together, but Closing of the American Mind, Alan Bloom's famous book about the sort of takeover of universities by left-wing ideas that use sanctions to back the force of persuasiveness. That book bears a copyright of 1987. And the relevant ideas about how universities should operate and the hiring practices, you know, you read the core texts from like a Catherine McKinnon or someone like that. Many of them were published in the 70s or early 80s. What we really see is more like a 50-year project that has gained steam almost every year. A few reversals this year, but essentially an ideological takeover of the universities that has extended over 50 years. That's not quick.
What has been quick has been the fall in public confidence and public trust from 2015 to 2023, a steep fall off. And that 2023 figure is predates the testimony of the three university presidents.
That's very interesting. But that suggests that universities can behave very badly for decades before there's any sort of reckoning.
What also changed, I think, quickly, and one reason why I think the public fall off in confidence is, as we were discussing, very much deserved, and it pains me to say that, is that the ability of many, or self-perceived ability of many in universities to challenge ideas, like, you know, Catherine McKinnon, okay, so she has interesting ideas. Plenty of people thought they were ideas worth pondering, and plenty of people then thought that they were ideas worth critiquing. I agree with this, I don't agree with that, et cetera, et cetera. That's exactly how universities are supposed to function. Someone comes up with some ideas that are novel, and then they're taken seriously, and they're subject to analysis. What I think has fueled the precipitous drop in public confidence is our reports that universities aren't functioning that way anymore, that a new idea is advanced, and then it has to be accepted, or people's careers or social lives or whatever are in grave danger. That's caused, I think, the great fall off in public confidence. And that's what I hope to see reversed soon. And I hope universities will recognize that, that they actually could end up having endowments taxed. In addition, universities have enjoyed a privileged position because of the system of accreditation. And there have been some very interesting and I think important reform proposals advanced recently to remove requirements of accreditation or to change the system of accreditation. I think that's something that deserves a great deal of attention.
So let me pivot now to sort of a related sphere of activity, but not identical. I guess I'll introduce it this way. A lot of folks suppose that these ideological activities are happening primarily in the humanities, maybe in certain parts of the social sciences, but not in science, not in, you know, physics, biology, chemistry, mathematics, and not in medicine. Medicine, like, the idea is that the way universities work, surely the way they must work, is that with respect to the, sometimes they're called the soft disciplines, right? But that's where, by the way, I make my home. I'm a philosopher lawyer. In those disciplines, there might be a lot of ideology pretending to be truth-seeking scholarship. But in the areas of physics and math and medicine, universities are doing what they always have done and should do, and that is pursuing the best science possible. After all, it's an empirical discipline. And I'd like to ask you about the sphere of science and medicine. Is scholarship really happening? Is the best science really happening? Are people feeling unfree in those areas? And is the feeling of not being free justified in those areas? And what might be done about that, if so?
I think there are three main problems. The first is that there has been a lot of work done which has not withstood scrutiny. The replication crisis in psychology is such that many, many prominent findings just haven't been replicated, however one might want to define that term.
Mm-hmm.
There are also a number of prominent studies that have had to have been withdrawn. Now, of course, science works this way. There are going to be a lot of mistakes, and what we want is to have a process where errors are quickly corrected and so forth. But the fact that the president of Stanford had to resign, in part because of very serious questions about the conscientiousness of his work, we have had other...
And the president of Harvard.
Those are very serious developments, and they are areas where universities, where science has got to be seen to be, in effect, self-monitoring in a way that it is simply not.
You're putting this very delicately, but is what you're saying fundamentally that a lot of false research is being produced in science, and maybe knowingly false research, like corrupt research?
There's a concern, and it's a real concern, that corners have been cut, that those who are, as you know, many scientific papers have many, many, many authors. And so there is no one sometimes who is actually taking the time to make sure that everything lines up, that incentives have been created such that those who come forward with exciting breakthroughs will have their careers flourish. Those who work very hard and find out what's not working will be rewarded less. So,
does it have an ideological orientation? So what I mean by that is...
That's the next thing. So that's problem number one. So just separating all this out, problem number one is a lot of research, not the majority of research probably, but we really don't know, right? A lot of research that has turned out to be shoddy or worse. Problem number one. Problem number two is the perception that some questions can't be asked because of ideological valence.
But surely that affects things like, psychology and sociology, but not physics, right? Are there questions that can't be asked in physics?
I don't know. Because, right?
What about in medicine?
I just don't know. In medicine, absolutely.
So what are some examples?
I think there are some questions that people are not willing to ask, and I think we need to think, and I think that, or there are, as you know, sometimes studies that could be undertaken where there would be a more popular and a less popular outcome. There's a lot of concern that ideology leads to non-publication of results. After all, every researcher is working on a lot of projects, and if something seems not to be coming out a way that would be helpful to their career or something seems to be coming out in a way that might cause some difficulty, there's an understandable temptation to just not go forward with the
Can you give
project.
Me an example of sort of a question that can't be asked, or a piece of research that was withdrawn, or something like that, just to understand what
so
this
I
is
think,
all about?
I think anything that has to do with sex differences, for example, is going to be delicate. I'm not suggesting people proceed like bulls in china shops, indifferent to the feelings of
you
others.
Mean sex differences in terms of like characteristic differences in men and women, like personality differences?
Personality differences, spatial reasoning, I mean, you name
oh,
it,
I
right?
See.
Any kind
Ability
of
Ability differences.
Any kind of sex difference. And even if one is not making any kind of claim as to whether or not something is nature or nurture, the fact that Larry Summers, who was then president of Harvard, got into difficulty when he speculated, which perhaps was unwise to do, but still, he showed up and he speculated about representation
this was
of females.
This was a thought that, like, the bell curves for female abilities are flatter than, or excuse me, are less flat than those for men. So there's
no,
less...
Flatter.
No, the
but,
men are
I
flatter,
mean,
so which is
flatter.
To say there's
more
men
the
at
tails.
The tails.
Right, the more men at the tails, exactly. The idea that speculating as to why we might see more males at the tails of measures of certain abilities can be a very bad career move. I mean, of course, people will see that. I think that's unfortunate. So we have to, I think about untangling these issues. And I think our third major problem is the loss of a sense of scientific community, a sense that to be a scientist is to engage in the pursuit of truth and to, in effect, let the chips fall where they may. And that in the event that someone comes forward with a result that's unpopular, that other scientists will back up that person.
It's also interesting, and it's a little unfamiliar to me, to be honest, since I don't work in these scientific worlds. But I have the following question as I think about the whole picture. Is it the case that, you know, you're getting ideologically motivated research or shoddy research or shutting down unpopular findings in certain specific areas that touch on hot button issues like sex differences or race or other you know, known quantities of hot button issues, but the rest of science is doing pretty well? Or is the... Because then I feel like I could look at the work of scientists and say, it's actually going great. They're doing wonderful research on, I don't know, neurology and brain surgery. And they're doing wonderful research on electrons and quantum mechanics. So they're doing wonderful research on, you name it. As long as it's not one of these hot button issues, it's everything science should be. Or is it more of a global spread? Like, whatever is wrong is affecting even the electron research, even the neurology research, and not just the hot button issues.
Well, the first set of problems we were discussing is exactly that, that there is shoddy research, and maybe worse than shoddy, research that has either been careless or might even, in some instances, be designed to deceive. That is
right.
A huge problem. How big is the problem? No way to know.
I just have no idea whether that's ideological in character or whether it's just bad science. Just
no, I don't think it's ideological in character. I would say if you wish to look at incentives, follow the money.
Mm.
And in terms of addressing the problem of shoddy research or even fraudulent research, figure out ways to incentivize scientists to do good, honest research.
Yeah.
You don't want to have the grant money flowing only to people who have come up with spectacular results.
So some of the shoddy research might have to do with where grants are coming from.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, humans will be motivated by flows of money. We've seen this from time to time,
mm-hmm.
so
mm-hmm.
that shouldn't surprise anyone that if spectacular research is rewarded and kind of good mule-like research is not rewarded so much, that we are going to be creating...
When you say spectacular research, you mean research that comes with, not that it's spectacularly well done, it's not Einstein's famous five papers.
But it's like a breakthrough. But it's like
right.
a breakthrough.
Yeah,
breakthrough,
but breakthroughs that you think are false, right? That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, but so that's a quality control issue. And I think issues like that can be addressed through crafting of incentives. Ideology is a bit tougher.
Yeah.
The idea that certain things, the second set of issues we were discussing, the idea that certain research projects can't be pursued or shouldn't be pursued, or if the wrong results, if they are, or something delicate is pursued, if the wrong result is coming out, maybe a study about the effects of, you know, long hours in daycare on children or something like that, something that could be a political hot button issue that researchers will not want to pour trouble and will decide to simply let the project quietly drop.
So those the phenomena we've been talking about in universities, the phenomena of ideological research and ideological education, I guess my conclusion is, from what you've said here, is that it's not just in the humanities or in the relatively soft social sciences. It's actually spreading into the hard sciences and into medicine, and it's not necessarily comprehensive in all of those areas. There might be spaces you can go where you're just doing science at the highest level that's available today. But there are significant areas within the hard sciences that are affected by this overarching ideological story we've been telling about not being free.
I think it's plausible.
Yeah. Okay, well, we have one more sphere to cover, and that is nonprofits. And here I'm not speaking of nonprofit universities, which we've just discussed, but nonprofit foundations, the big Ford foundations and MacArthur foundations. In these areas, one can reasonably think that there's a diversity. There are conservative foundations and there are liberal foundations. There's the Koch Brothers Foundation and there's the Ford and MacArthur Foundations. And so there's real money on both sides. And this is an area where, I don't know, maybe you're not completely free to speak your mind if you're employed at Koch Brothers or if you're employed at the Ford Foundation. But in choosing which one of these institutions to go to, you can get a reasonable kind of freedom to speak your you can align yourself with one where you can speak your mind at that institution. Is that right, or is this a sphere of life where, like all the others, people don't feel free and they don't feel free with good reason?
Well, there's definitely a perception that a lot of the major foundations have an ideological bent, and I think that's unfortunate. I think that they have a very important role to play in society. To be sure, big foundations are large concentrations of money, and there has always been a great deal of anxiety that with an enormous amount of money comes potentially political power, and that these private foundations might be politically active without accountability. And I share those concerns. That said, foundations are free to engage in a lot of research, explore a lot of ideas that would be tough for elected representatives possibly to explore. They can do, for example, pilot programs in education and health and so on, that it might be harder for a less well-financed or less supple institution to undertake. So with all that, yes, I would say that the private foundations that you're speaking of have a very, potentially very beneficial role to play in society, where they appear to be have been subject to ideological capture, such that their statements of factual findings become suspect. At that point, I think there is a huge problem.
With respect to nonprofits and foundations, one thing that I've observed is that a lot of their activities formally are classified as 501c3 activity. That's an IRS classification. And what it means is that they're engaged in charitable, educational, scientific, or related kinds of activities and are therefore enjoying certain tax advantages.
Yes.
And that's in distinction to 501c4, which is another kind of organization under the IRS regulations, which is a political advocacy organization.
Or a social welfare organization.
Or a
social welfare organization, which can include more political advocacy than for the 501c3s.
I see.
501c3s can receive contributions that are tax deductible up to a point to their donors. And so one question.
And in contrast, what's the regulation governing 501c4?
If you give $1 million to a 501c4, you do not get any tax deductions.
Okay, so there's a different treatment if they're engaged in a political advocacy or social welfare kind of program.
There are different treatments. And then there are other nonprofits that are not 501c4s or 501c3s. So as a society, we have given preferential tax treatment to organizations that, as you say, are engaged in charitable, educational, scientific, etc. purposes, and denied them to organizations that are said to be not straight up advocacy or political operatives.
So the worry is, I mean, everyone's allowed to form a foundation to promote whatever ideas they want to promote, but the worry is that 501c3 and 501c4 are getting co-opted. So that is to say, an organization is formed with the tax advantages of 501c3 status and then engages in a kind of advocacy where it properly should be seen as 501c4 or some third
or
classification altogether.
And that is the worry with a lot of our big foundations.
So
they are 501c3s. They have enjoyed enormous tax advantages, which we can discuss whether or not there should be such tax advantages and so forth. But the fact is there are. And in exchange for having dramatic, considerable tax advantages, they are supposed to be limiting their activities to the charitable, to the educational, and so forth, and not to be political actors.
Yeah.
Now, to be sure...
Can that line be maintained? I mean, it's hard to figure out what is an educational enterprise and what is a species of advocacy. They're so connected.
True. And the fact that there is bound to be a gray area is an argument for overhauling the system and not having 501c3s, saying it's so hard to differentiate politics from charity that we are simply going to no longer offer these special tax advantages and allow firms to be 501c3s, because we simply can't figure out which 501c3s deserve the 501c3 status and which do not. But given our current system, it seems to me we should at least make a good faith effort to distinguish firms that are behaving the way that 501c3s are supposed to behave from those that have crossed a line and have become political actors.
How does that work concretely? Would that mean that there was sort of a team at the IRS reviewing 501c3 applications to see if they're engaging in advocacy and making judgments about what counts as advocacy?
There is a team at the IRS that is charged with assessing firms as to whether or not they deserve 501c3 to get or maintain 501c3 status. Now, I mean, I'm open, frankly, to a number of different legal regimes in this area, but I'm not open to the idea that firms can get special tax advantages, claim 501c3 status, and then not act as a 501c3.
Yeah.
And when we discuss all non-501c3s, including leading universities, that is a to me anyway, real problem. And these organizations must be run in a way so that they are not, in effect, political actors. They need to be run in a way that, so long as we have 501c3 status available, they are in compliance with the requirements of 501c3 status.
If there were evidence that, let's say, some threshold, more than 90% of employees at a 501c3 are of the same political party, does that make out a case, even a prima facie case, for saying this can't possibly be an ideologically neutral organization? Sort of like, you prima facie lose 501c3 status as soon as 90% of your employees are of one party?
No, I do not think that.
You don't think that?
No, absolutely not, because I think a large number of people are able to separate their jobs from their voting and will do what they're supposed to be doing at work and will not be pursuing any kind of political project.
I actually find that hard to believe myself that, let's say that you're a 501c3 working on criminal justice reform, and 90, let's imagine it's very extreme, 98% of your employees are Democrats, or not just Democrats, but sort of like passionately involved in progressive projects in criminal justice reform. Maybe all former criminal defense lawyers who are former public defenders who are passionate about taking down a system they think is corrupt. I just can't fathom how they could carry forth their mission in a way that didn't evince a certain political bias. And by the way, same on the other side. I just can't see how that works sociologically.
Well, there we disagree. because I can imagine employees of such an organization devoting their time to doing research, not shoddy research, not fraudulent research, but real research about the effects of, say, different pilot programs, and then collecting and analyzing the research in a responsible way and disseminating it. I mean, sure, the people undertaking this project might be drawn to it for the same reasons that they are drawn to vote for a particular political party. That makes evident sense, but it doesn't mean that in doing work that is not by its nature some kind of retail political work, that they are inevitably promoting a retail politics agenda.
Well, I don't know. I mean, essentially what you're saying is methodology is the solution to ideology, that if people are rigorous about the research, then their politics become irrelevant because the methodology sort of insulates the findings from their ideology. But I don't think that's how research generally works, or at least it's extremely hard to accomplish.
That it's hard to
methodology is extremely manipulable, and I've almost never seen a case where it is immune from strong assumptions, especially when those strong assumptions are sociologically reinforced.
Well, I'm not claiming that the system will work perfectly, but I certainly think it can work well enough.
Yeah.
And that it is not inevitable that a group of employees, even if 98% of them contribute to the Democratic Party, will,
or vice versa,
will inevitably end up producing work that furthers the interests of the major political party they happen to be supporting. Not at all. I think that there are facts. I think that they are discernible often. I think that there are better ideas and worse ideas in the public policy realm. I think that many people will be intellectually honest enough to explain things. And I also think it's very important to note that when you look at the relationship between these, say, nonprofits that are hypothetically overwhelmingly staffed by members of or supporters of one political party, that it's a two-way street, that what the major political party ends up with as its program can be influenced by the organizations, by nonprofit, non-political organizations. It's not that the people working for these nonprofits are eager to do the bidding of those running the political parties.
No.
Those running the political parties will pay attention to the work being done by nonprofits. And it's true that someone who is in charge of or working in a serious policy job for a major political party might well be more interested in the research that is being carried out by a nonprofit that they know is staffed by those who are likely to sympathize with them. It's not inevitable, right? Not inevitable that that's going to be the only source that they look to. We have seen over time political parties, in effect, change their policies, change their objectives, change their arguments, and sometimes that's in response to ideas put forth by parties, by individuals and firms that are more associated with the other side.
When have we seen that?
Welfare.
Okay, can you talk a little bit about that example?
1990s. I mean, you can think of the Democrats in the 1990s adopted welfare reform. They adopted a lot of ideas that, or at least were sympathetic to a lot of ideas that had been developed by some of the major think tanks that were thought to be more, quote, conservative.
And so your vision is of one where we use the 501c3 apparatus to essentially enforce a genuine commitment to helping others or to truth-seeking not engaging in political advocacy. And the difference between political advocacy and truth-seeking is fundamentally about the rigor of one's methodology.
Yes. And there will be a gray area.
And there will be a gray area in
I'm not suggesting that you can draw a bright line, but I do think there is a gray area, and I do think that there are a number of things that we don't have any trouble identifying as being in column A or in column B.
Right.
Also criminal justice reform. We are seeing a number of Republican politicians very interested in criminal justice reform, and a lot of the ideas that they're at least willing to explore have seeds, or at least arguably some origins, in more, quote, left-wing organizations. I think this is all healthy. It's exactly, to me anyway, how the system is supposed to work.
Well, Julia, I always love talking with you. I always learn something, and I always find something out. I think at a number of points in the conversation, you've been more optimistic than me about the prospects for things getting better. And I guess what I want to say about that is I really hope you're right. I've never more wanted to be wrong than in talking with you.
I am optimistic. So I'll end with a bold prediction.
Okay.
I think it is more likely than not that the greatest days of the United States of America lie ahead.
Thank you.
Yes.
Again, I fervently hope you're right.
Thank you.